continued to erode, and the only place we can go to make up the difference is to people who listen. And here's something you can think about. Maybe, well, is WILL and the programming you get on this station worth a dollar a day? Well, maybe so. Maybe you could actually pledge at $365. Maybe you couldn't do that. Maybe you could make a contribution of $250. Or 75, maybe even just at the basic membership level, which is $40. We know that if we could get 400 people who had never contributed before to join at that level, the $40 basic level, that would mean $16,000 for us here at WILL, and that's a significant amount of money. So if it's time for you to renew, we hope you would. If you've never made a contribution before, we hope you would do that. It's very easy. You can call us right now and talk with one of our pledge volunteers. The number is 244-9455, and 217 is the area code. You can also pledge online. Go to our website, will.uiuc.edu. Well, this is Focus 580. It's our morning talk program. My name is David Inge. Glad to have you with us. We're also pleased to have here in the studio with us Barbara Burkhart. She is assistant professor of English at University of Illinois at Springfield and is the author of the book William Maxwell, A Literary Life, published by the University of Illinois Press. We're glad to have you here. Questions, by the way, are welcome if there are people who are listening who would like to call in and talk with her. That's welcome, as always. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. We do also have toll-free line, good anywhere that you can hear us, and that is 800-222-9455. Well, thanks very much for being here.
Oh, good morning. Thank you.
I appreciate it. William Maxwell had a very long life and a very productive career. He was born in 1908, lived until 2000. When he passed, he was 91 years old, was at the New Yorker for a long, long time. That's really a remarkable career when you think about the amount of time, you think about how much the world changed, think about how writing changed over that time. It's really, really remarkable.
Absolutely. He lived to be just about a week shy of his 92nd birthday and really wrote into his late 80s. He was still writing stories for The New Yorker, so it was a remarkable and very long career. And he was at The New Yorker as an editor for 40 years, from 1936 to 76. So
that's also astonishing. Yeah. And he actually, I think I have this right, that he started work on the magazine when it was only 10 years old.
That's right, exactly. Exactly. And he worked with Harold Ross, the first editor of The New Yorker, and then when he died in the 50s, William Shawn came on, and Maxwell worked with him as well. But a number of the writers that he worked with were probably more known to most Americans and readers, John Updike and Eudora Welty and Vladimir Nabokov and others. But the book, this book is has a little bit about that as well as part of his career, but I think I focus mostly on his own work and his Illinois connection.
Well, that is, again, when you think about the number of people that he had the opportunity to work with, and The New Yorker has always been an important place for publishing fiction.
Sure.
And if you can get your story published in The New Yorker, it's a great thing.
That's right.
And some of the people that you touch on, some of the biggest names in literature last century, and they continue, obviously, to be important names. People continue to read them. He had the opportunity to work with all of these people. Were some of them, when he started, were some of them not yet well-established, or were they as well-known, almost as well-known, when he met them and started to work with them as they are?
Yeah. Both. Someone like John Updike was just beginning. He started writing for The New Yorker in the 50s, and he was a young, up-and-coming writer, but very quickly became very well-known and became part of The New Yorker staff. So he was young when Maxwell started working with him. When, for example, Vladimir Nabokov, when he worked with Maxwell, he was already an international figure and had worked with Catherine White, another New Yorker editor, prior to working with Maxwell. So he had sort of both ends of the spectrum, working with newcomers who then became very famous and very well-known, and those who already were established.
Hmm. How did you come to meet him and get the opportunity to spend as much time talking with him as you did, that and then ended up in this book?
Yes. Well, I got my master's degree. I got my bachelor's here at Urbana, and then my master's at UIS, which is then Sangamon State University. And I wrote a review of one of his books. It was an essay collection called The Outermost Dream. And someone from our University of Illinois Alumni Association here in Urbana sent him that review. It appeared in the Illinois Times in Springfield, and he wrote to me. And so our correspondence began there. And then when I got here at Urbana for my PhD, there was a wonderful group at Parkland College, and they had a literary magazine called Tamaqua. And they were doing a special literary focus on him in one of their issues, and they wanted to someone to go interview him. And so I was really pleased to volunteer and went out. And that started that was 1991, the first time I met him. And really got to know him over the last 10 years of his life. The picture on the cover was a photo I took during one of our interviews. That one was at his country home that you're seeing there. And one interesting thing is that he liked to type the answers to the interviews. You may have read that when you looked at the book. And that was a very, very interesting thing. It sounds odd, but it actually seemed pretty natural for him to do that. And it doesn't mean we didn't talk by any means, but we did. I had a lot of chance to take photos, as you see there. But it was an interesting thing. He said he thought better on the typewriter than he did just talking. Mm-hmm. And so by the time we were done with many interviews, I had about 50 pages of his typing to use for the book. So
now, there's a writer for you, a guy who thinks better with his hands on the keyboard.
I know.
It seems a little, I could imagine doing an interview that way. And it seems just a little, the idea seems a little disconcerting, that is, you would ask the question to the guy, and then he would sit there and start banging away at the typewriter.
Yeah.
But that was the way that he wanted to do it, and obviously the result was good.
The result, it was. It was very good. And it was kind of funny. The first time I went, I was a student. I took my tape recorder. I took everything. And, of course, I had my tape recorder going. And I got home and it was all clicking on my type, on my tape. But you know, he was a quiet man, and it sounds unusual and maybe a bit odd, but it just worked very well. And then as I got going there more often, I went probably out once or twice a year. Then he didn't do this anymore. We just talked. But I also was really fortunate. One of the times when I was in his country place, he had two places, one in Manhattan and one in upstate New York. And I was there, and he showed me all the letters that he had from everyone, from all the writers of The New Yorker, and also from family and friends in Illinois, in Lincoln particularly, and some from Urbana. Professor Charles Shattuck, who was a professor here at Urbana for many years, he's no longer living, but they were lifelong friends. So he had just thousands and thousands of letters, and they are now at the University of Illinois here at Urbana. But I cataloged those, so he would send those to me at my home in Springfield at that time, and I would go through them. So I saw those in the country home, and it was just lovely, and his wife was lovely too.
This is a great photograph of here on the cover.
Thank
where
you.
He's doing it, as you say. He's sitting and typing in response to your questions, and this was an electric typewriter. He actually had the plug inside the house and had a cord running outside so he could sit outside and sit with you and talk and type.
He did. One of my funniest memories probably of him is that he had this cord through the window onto this picnic table, and he like scissor kicked over it. You know, he was in his early to mid 80s at that time, and he was just very, very nimble for a man of his age.
Well, you mentioned three connections with Illinois and with the University of Illinois. Mm-hmm. First, that he was born not all that far from here. He was born in Lincoln. He went to the University of Illinois. I think that he also taught here briefly. It was a short amount of time.
He did.
And his papers are now here.
Yes.
At the University of Illinois.
Yes, they are. He came here, he graduated from high school in Chicago in 1926 and then was here and graduated in 1930 from Illinois. He went to Harvard for a year and got a master's, came back for his PhD here, and then he taught here from 31 to 33. And I know some of your listeners may know of the Busey family. Well, Greta Busey from that family, she was in the English department, and she's the one that kind of got him going on perhaps leaving and trying to become a writer. She was one of the big influences. So then in 33, he left Urbana to go to New York. Mm-hmm. And then wrote his first novel, partially in Wisconsin, partially here, and then got hired in 1936 by The New Yorker.
He is so often described as being a Midwestern writer. Mm-hmm. And you know, I know that certainly there are people who are Southern writers and there are people who are Western writers and there are people who are big city writers that you associated with places like Chicago or New York. And I have heard other writers referred to as Midwestern, and I guess I'm never quite sure what that means. What do you think about that designation as being a Midwestern writer? And in his case in particular, because you over and over again write about how grounded he seemed to be in the Midwest, mm-hmm. how much of his own life and his feelings about the place that he grew up and spent his childhood end up in the writing. Can you talk about that, his being a Midwestern writer?
Sure. Well, one thing, he did believe that what he wrote about, the human experience he wrote about, was more important than where it happened. Mm. So some people would consider him a Midwestern writer. Those in New York and on the East Coast probably would not, in a sense. But I think the land, the sense of landscape in his work is very important, sort of a sense of exposure. As you read his fiction, you'll find passages in which he's describing the land. I know in So Long, See You Tomorrow, for example, he talks about riding the carriage out with his father to the farmland they owned and the sense of exposure. And I think that's echoed in his work, because in his prose, the very language he uses is very barren, particularly in the later work. It gets more and more so. And it seems to me that those really mirror each other. Mm-hmm. So in that sense, I think the land is important, the barrenness, both in terms of emotion and in terms of landscape. And then I think the sense of home is the most important. It just happens that the Midwest is his home, particularly Lincoln, Illinois, is his home. And so he's always trying to come back to that place. His mother died when he was 10 in the 1918 influenza epidemic, and this really became the central fact of his life and later of his work. And so trying to come back to this place in time was always very important to him. Mm-hmm. And I guess when we think of other Midwestern writers, maybe Edgar Lee Masters or Theodore Dreiser, some other writers who left smaller towns in the Midwest, Sherwood Anderson would be another example, and typically went to Chicago or New York, disillusioned with the small town Midwest. Maxwell never had that happen to him, because when he was 14, his family moved to Chicago, and he never outgrew Lincoln. He still loved it, and so it always stayed as it was in his mind as when he was a child. Mm-hmm. So his fiction is always coming back to that place, to his mother and the place that she nurtured. Yeah. And so that's really what his whole body of work is about. He does have one novel, The Folded Leaf, that he published in 1945 that was set in Chicago at his high school, Senn High School, and at Urbana. And most of it actually is here at the University of Illinois. And it's very interesting. It's quite autobiographical about his time here in the late 20s. And I think, in fact, the latest edition of that has a picture of the quad on the cover from that period. So it might be of interest to people in this area.
There's a story in here that if I'm remembering it right, he was at an artist colony.
Yes.
And went out for a drive with another guy.
Yes.
Saul Cohen. And maybe there are people around here who remember Saul Cohen. I never met him, but I know who Saul Cohen and was. And I've heard interviews with Saul Cohen.
Oh, really? Great.
And so he and Saul went out for a drive and they got lost, mm-hmm. and it started to get dark. And he talks in the story about how the fact that there were mountains made him really uncomfortable. It wasn't just the fact that they were lost. It was a lost. It was getting dark. There were mountains all mm-hmm. around. And he talks in the story about how if it had been out on the prairie and it had been flat and open, it wouldn't have bothered him
as much. That's right. He said something like, that flat landscape in the sky and the infinity of that was made his mind peaceful, or mm-hmm. it was assuring to him, as opposed to the mountains. And he always felt that way. I mean, I guess I feel that way when I come and drive across the plain. I understand what he's talking about.
Yeah, I think so too. And I think that's one of this kind of landscape, I think, has virtues, but maybe you have to live with it for mm-hmm. a while before you mm-hmm. appreciate them. Mm-hmm. You know, all the famous stories about people coming from other places where they have water and mountains and things like that.
That's right.
And they say, it's so flat. It's flat as the top of this table that we're sitting at. And we'd say, well, yeah, but there are a lot of things that are really beautiful about it. And it may be in that kind of landscape, small things end up looming large just mm-hmm. because it is
That's
so flat.
That's true. And Maxwell really, I think more than any writer I can think of, other than perhaps Willa Cather, captures that sense of the beauty of the land and the appreciation, I guess, of the land. And you were talking about Midwestern writers. Reminds me that of all of them, he probably had felt most affinity with Willa Cather. in their writing style, in how they approached writing about people on the prairie and that kind of thing.
We have a caller here. Believe it or not, they say they're calling from Austin, Texas, so they must be listening on the internet because the signal doesn't travel quite that far. Let's talk with them here on our line number four. Hello.
Good morning, Dr. Burkhardt.
Hello. How are you?
I'm doing well, thank you. Yes, the web is terrific. great way to tune in. But I wanted to ask, and hopefully this question hasn't been asked yet, but was there anything interesting or noteworthy that didn't make it into the book?
Oh, that's a good question. Yeah, I worked on it a long time. And so, you know, you gather information, and some of the information you just can't use for whatever reason. You have to be selective. I guess what comes to mind first, one scene, I write about Maxwell's life and my visits with him and then always transition into talking about his work. And one scene that I wish I could have put in was one visit that I made, and his wife had broken her hip and she was walking with a walker. And I had never seen anyone walk, so she looked like Audrey Hepburn. She had this beautiful carriage about her, and I would have liked to have written more about his wife, I think, because after his death, the death of his mother, she was the most important person to him, and so I think I would have liked to have included a bit more of that, but probably that was it. Yeah, thanks for the question.
Sure.
All right. Well, thank you very much. Other people who are listening, if you have questions, you can call 333-9455. We do also have a toll-free line, and that one is good anywhere that you might happen to be listening, and that's 800-222-9455. If you're listening over the air in and around Illinois and Indiana, use that. If you're listening on the internet, as long as you're in the United States, you also may use that number, and that is 800-222-9455. As you said, his childhood experiences growing up in Lincoln and then also in Chicago stayed with him all the rest of his life and entered into his writing. And maybe one of the most significant things that happened to him was, as you said, was the loss of his mother, who died in the great flu pandemic she died in 1919, I believe.
Yes, yeah, January 3rd.
And when he was just a boy. And then when he was a teenager, the family moved to Chicago. His father remarried, and he had another kind of life than he might have led if he just lived out all of his life in Lincoln.
Absolutely.
Maybe before going on to that, let's just talk a little bit about the significance to him of the loss of his mom when he was so young.
Yes, well, it was just devastating to him. In fact, my first chapter is about his early life, and rather than open when he was born, I open with the moment that he found out about his mother's death, because it was everything to him. It changed his view of the world. He said at that moment the shine went out of everything. And so one thing that did for later in his life for his fiction was that it kept his fiction from being sentimental, because while he was writing about this wonderful world that he knew with his mother in this wonderful home on 9th Street in Lincoln, Illinois, it was always shadowed by the notion that something bad could happen without warning. And at 10 years old, he learned that people weren't safe. And so this idea, I think Maxwell has a real balance. He has this idea that the tragedy could be behind any door at any moment, and you will never know when it's coming, as it happened to him. But then also this joy of all these wonderful things that he experienced. And a lot of it is domestic joy. That's where his joy came from, both in his life and in his work. Mm-hmm. Just the minute little things, from his mother's tea parties on a wicker cart to his dad's, you know, neighborhood orchestra practicing in the living room, all of those things. That was where he got his joy. So he balances that with the idea that tragedy could be around the corner.
Yeah. Well, we'll talk some more in a moment here about the life of William Maxwell. One thing that I want to make sure that we mention, that you are here on the campus in connection with an event that will be happening at the Rare Book Collection.
Yes.
You want to take a moment to talk about what's going to be going
on? Sure, yes, thank you. The Library Friends are sponsoring an event today. It's at 4 o'clock at the Rare Book and Special Collections Library, which is in the main library building here on the campus at University of Illinois. And I'll be talking briefly about the book, also perhaps some about the collection. That is the room where the collection is housed. And I think there'll be a reception afterwards, so we welcome anyone to come.
Mm-hmm, good. Well, we certainly welcome people, if you'd like to call in this morning, ask questions of our guest, Barbara Burkhart. She is Assistant Professor of English at University of Illinois, Springfield, and is author of the book William Maxwell, A Literary Life. It's published by the U of I Press. And if you're interested in reading the book, you can head out to the bookstore. Any quality bookstore had better have that book.
That's right.
Jack Brighton here has now stepped into the studio. He's former producer of Focus 580, producer emeritus, we like to call him, occasionally sits in as host, and is also the guy who oversees now our web operations. We had a call, I don't know if you heard, we had someone call from Austin, Texas.
Yes, I did.
Who very obviously was not listening over the air.
That's great.
So, it's one of the ways that we have extended the reach of the station, and I think that it's pretty cool because it means that really anybody in the world, if they want to, can be listening to us right now. And, of course, we also have the web archive, which I think is also a great thing because it gives people the opportunity to go back and hear programs that they might have missed that they want to listen to again. That is a great resource. Of course, there, all of my flaws are on permanent record.
I edit those out.
Forever.
I just chop those right out.
Oh, good. I'm glad. I feel much better about that now.
It's a tough challenge, but...
yeah, there's so many of them.
That was mean. I'm sorry.
Well, anyway, what we're looking for this morning is... we're going to take just a second here, and we'll talk some more with Barbara. But take just a second here to encourage people to cajole, to say everything that we possibly can to get people to make a contribution to the station.
That's right. And you can do that right now by calling our pledge line, 244-9455, with your annual membership contribution. If you've never made a contribution before, you've never called that line before, believe me, it'll take a minute and you'll feel good about yourself because this is the kind of show that covers ideas, literature, writers, the kinds of things that people find, I think a lot of people find very intriguing, you just don't find anywhere else on the dial. So we ask you to support it by making that pledge call, 244-9455. You can also pledge online. So that person in Austin or wherever else you're listening online, you can actually pledge on our website. Every page has a pledge link at the top. So just use that. And, you know, I do want to, you know, sort of repeat what you said about the archives. A lot of people don't realize, but we have archives, audio archives from the show going back to 1998. And I'm doing everything possible to extend it earlier because we've got tapes of things before that. So it takes a lot of work, but we're trying to get that done. Also wanted to note that I knew Saul Cohen.
You did?
Yes,
oh,
yes.
Wow.
And used to deliver his newspaper, as a matter of fact.
Really?
Wow, where was that?
Here in Urbana.
Really?
Yeah.
Wow, didn't know that.
Yeah. When that name popped up in the book, I thought, Saul Cohen. I know about Saul Cohen.
Yeah.
In fact, that happens a lot with if you've been in Champaign-Urbana or around the University of Illinois long enough, that happens a lot in this book when their names – and there may not be – they're not people I ever personally met, but there are names – people that I know by name. And so I think particularly it would be interesting for people who are familiar with Maxwell or not, but for people who have been living in Champaign-Urbana for you know, long time, 10, 20, 30, 40 years more.
Yeah. We'll stop there. And by the way, we're supposed to be raising money, David.
Oh, so I'm sorry.
Let's check in with Maeve Riley, who's the editor of our Patterns program guide. She's in the Pledge Center, and I know we're enjoying this discussion of literature, Maeve, but
yes.
Are we getting people to call us with their contributions?
No, the phones are a little bit slow right now, so all you need to do is go to the phone and call 217-244-9455. We've got a special deal for maybe some of those longtime Urbana residents who've been around. Maybe they knew William Maxwell way back when. Mm-hmm. And some very kind friends of WILL, Bill and Nancy McDonald, will give half of a senior citizen or student, if you're a student listening to this interesting discussion, they will provide half of your membership, which is $25. So all you have to do is plop down $12.50. You'll become a friend of WILL and support fine programming like Focus 580. Give us a call, 217-244-9455.
I also want to suggest as a membership level, $1 a week, folks, $52 a year. I mean, is this show worth $1 a week to you? Ask yourself that, and then hopefully the answer is yes, and then make a pledge call, 244-9455.
All right. Thank you very much. We'll continue our conversation here with Barbara Burkhart. The number, if you'd like to call in on this program, separate from pledging, 833-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Barbara Burkhardt is assistant professor of English at the U of I Springfield. She got her Ph.D. in American Literature from the U of I here in Urbana-Champaign. During the last 10 years of Maxwell's life, William Maxwell, she had an opportunity to spend a lot of time talking with him, visited him at his homes in New York City and in Westchester County in New York, and those conversations helped make the basis for this biography that she has written of William Maxwell, titled William Maxwell, A Literary Life, published by the U of I Press. She also was involved in organizing his personal papers that are here now at the University of Illinois. And again, as I say, questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. Here is a caller in Champaign, line one. Hello.
Hello. Good morning. I would love to hear Professor Burkhardt speak, but I can't make it. Anyway, I'm very interested in the literary life, so interested that we pledged the WILL twice, not just once. I just want to remind everybody that this weekend is Mother's Day, and I'm a mom, so I think losing your mom is a very major thing, and I'm really sympathetic with William Maxwell. And I'll hang up and listen to your reddish response. Thank you very much.
Well, thanks for the call. That is something that we did talk a little bit about. It. And for, again, if maybe people weren't listening a little bit earlier, the fact that his mother died in 1919 is one of the people that were killed by the flu, the influenza, the great influenza the time. And that was something that was, for the rest of his life, a very important one of those kind of life-shaping events.
It was. I don't think he ever got over it. Oh, I know he never got over it, even to the end of his life, the end of his 91 years. I think it was just a tragedy in his life that really shaped him as a person in many ways. In fact, this is a little bit off the subject, but John Updike had come here in 97, I think, to honor Maxwell's gift of papers. And when he was here, we went to Lincoln. He wanted to see the sites in Maxwell's books. Mm-hmm. And one of them was to see the mother's grave. Her name was Blossom, which was, I think, such a lovely name and so unusual. And he'd read the book and wrote me a postcard a couple of weeks ago, and he said, "Remember when we were at the cemetery and looked down and saw Blossom?" You know, it was just so... I think Maxwell writes about, in fact, my mother had died not too long before I read So Long, See You Tomorrow. And I thought that he captured that experience, because I was much older than he was when he lost his mother, but I thought he captured that experience so beautifully. And that's another reason why I just was drawn to him.
Mm-hmm. One of the things I think is very interesting about him is just how important in his life women were.
Absolutely.
As source,
absolutely,
as inspiration. Mm-hmm. You talked about how he was perhaps influenced by Willa Cather. Mm-hmm. I know from having looked at the book that Virginia Woolf was important. And then there was this woman, Zora Gale, who was a Midwestern writer of the time and was very important for him as she was a lot older. He was a little boy. Mm-hmm. She was a grown-up woman, but was very important for him as a literary influence, as a mentor. Perhaps you can talk about that. Women and their importance in his
Absolutely.
Life.
They were very important. And when I think about his influences, I am pressed to think of a male influence in terms of his life and literature. When he was in high school, he went from Chicago to a farm that was about 10 miles outside of Portage, Wisconsin, which is not too far from Madison. And he met there two women, one, a Mrs. Green, who owned the farm where he lived. And it was really kind of a artist colony more than a farm. This is where he wrote his first novel and did chores and that kind of thing. And Mrs. Green gave him the place and support to nurture his writing at the very earliest stages, from high school through college and in his early adulthood. Then he had the opportunity to meet one of her friends, who is Zona Gale, who was at the time very well known. She had just won the Pulitzer Prize for a play of her novel called Miss Lulu Bett, and Maxwell got to meet her. She was the first feminist he knew, I'm sure, but she also was a writer. She'd gone out to New York. She'd won a big literary prize, $15,000, like in the late teens. Came home to Portage, built a big house with her and her parents could live there. And so she then supported herself with the writing for the rest of her life. And I think that was an example for Maxwell, that he could turn his own material of his young life into fiction, like she did. Then later in his life, when he was at the New Yorker, Well, I already mentioned Greta Busey, by the way. That was probably a good local connection for him. A poet named Louise Bogan, she was a poet and a critic, and she had some short fiction. She was a mentor for him, really in a very literary kind of way. She helped him and gave him support when he was writing the novel The Folded Leaf, which is the one about Urbana in Chicago. So she was very helpful, read his manuscript of that book four or five different versions over about a period of 4 years, and was very helpful to him. And then of the writers he didn't meet but whose works he admired included Colette, included Virginia Woolf, probably first and foremost, and Willa Cather, and also the poet. When he was here at Urbana, he loved the poet Eleanor Wiley, and his earlier fiction kind of mimics some of her kind of imagery that she uses.
You know, I think that for a long time now, I think you'd have to acknowledge, one would have acknowledged that one of the toughest challenges for a writer, whether that writer's man or woman, is to get into the head of the opposite gender.
Right, right. You know?
How was he, if you look at women characters in his writing, do you think that he was particularly good about that, or particularly sensitive to women and how they viewed the world?
Well, I think he was. I do, though, think that that's an overlooked aspect of his fiction. And one of the reasons I think that is because the central female figure in all of his work is a figure in absentia, really.
It's
always his mother. And she's not there. She's there, but he never gets inside her head, really. I will note there is one case in which that happened. And that was in a unpublished, unproduced play that he wrote that I found in the collection when he sent it to me that's now at Urbana. And it's a play in which he brings her back to life. And it's a very interesting play. He was in psychoanalysis with a man named Theodor Reich, who was a Freud protege in the 40s. And the play is about him with Theodor Reich and then his mother coming back and him trying to get over the grief, really. So that was interesting. But really, women were just very, very influential to him. And I in his own work, the one book, I think, Time Will Darken It, is the one novel where I think he really deals with women in a very significant way. He has several female figures in which he gets inside of their heads, and it's really good. It reminds me somewhat of the work of Cather or Kate Chopin or a number of female writers who are a little bit older than him. But he set it in that novel in 1912, and it's not as well read as often read as some of his other works, but I would recommend it for those interested in that area of his work.
He was in psychoanalysis with Reich.
He was
really intensely for more than a year. He went 5 days a week. That's an awful lot of time to spend on the couch.
Yes.
Why did he do that, and what did he feel that he gained from the experience?
Well, he did it because he was still having this period of grief. He was not married. He wanted desperately to be married. He was lonely. It started in about 1944 when he was writing The Folded Leaf. He was writing a book based on his experience at Urbana. When he was here as a sophomore, he attempted to commit suicide. And that's the climax of that novel. And so I think that as he was writing that, a lot of these things surfaced. He was lonely. He wanted to be married, and someone, a friend of his, recommended that he go see Theodor Reich, which is a wonderful thing for him to have done. Reich saw a number of artists and writers as patients, and he was very attuned to that whole artistic sensibility. And he also had a lot to do with Maxwell's writing at that time. Maxwell was writing The Folded Leaf, he actually advocated for Maxwell to rewrite the ending. He originally ended the novel in the hospital room when he was recovering from self-inflicted wounds, and Reich said no, he wanted Limey, the character representing Maxwell, to be more home free, he called it. Mm-hmm. So Maxwell wrote it that way, rewrote it, and reworked it to Reich's specifications, and then the critics panned that ending because it was unbelievable that he could suddenly be everything would
it was
be fine.
It was too much of a turnaround.
So in the 50s, he had a chance to issue a reissue, and he put it back the way he had it, and that's the definitive version. And if you buy it now, that's what it would be. But it was a very interesting view of how Reich had such an influence on him. Later in his career, when people said, oh, you should write it this way or this way, particularly in So Long, See You Tomorrow, William Shawn, for example, at the New Yorker, was asking some questions about why he was in the head of his dog. He had the dog's point of view.
Yeah.
And Maxwell stood his ground, but he was, you know, in his 70s then. So it was really interesting to see how he'd come so far in his just confidence about his own artistic vision.
That was, I think you explained, that the first of all of Maxwell's writing. That was the first thing that you ever read.
It was.
So Long, See You Tomorrow. And
yes.
I guess there were some people, perhaps you would think that that was the best thing that he wrote in all of his writing career?
Well, I think so. It's a short novel. It's 135 pages. I think it's a coalescence of a lot of the themes that he, you know, dealt with over the 60 years that he was writing. It's a blend of fact and fiction. It's set primarily in Lincoln, but we know that this narrator is in New York, so it kind of bridges all of the poles of his writing, from Lincoln to New York, from, you know, he mentions his analyst a bit, to his father figure, you know, in Lincoln. It's very well written. It's a condensed view of everything that he's been working on for all that time.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's not to say The Folded Leaf is a wonderful novel, particularly if you're from here. It would be very interesting to you, and depending on your age, you may even recognize a few people in it. But I think The Folded Leaf, They Came Like Swallows, is also lovely. It was his first well-known novel in 1937 about the mother's death. That was his first treatment of his mother's death.
Mm.
But So Long, I'd have to say, if you haven't read Maxwell yet, I would probably recommend you read that first.
You were talking about the Folded Leaf and how he wanted to end it, how his analyst wanted him to end it, about how he did indeed do that and then went back later and kind of changed it.
Right.
So that the ending that he had in mind was more uncertain somehow.
That's right.
I mean,
yes.
you were left with a question about what the rest of the life of this character was going to be.
Exactly.
Like. And that Reich really was hoping, and perhaps what he was also saying to Maxwell is, what I'm hoping for you, and not just what I'm hoping for your character, what I'm hoping for you is to recognize that you are also at a turning point.
Exactly.
In your life, and that it can indeed go in a more positive
mm-hmm.
direction, and you can be happier and
exactly.
have those things in your life that you want. So that indeed was what was going on at the time mm-hmm. that did indeed represent a kind of change that happened in his life, and
yes.
probably because he spent that time in therapy.
Absolutely. It was a definite turning point for him. He said he felt like a tree, you know, that was not complete, that didn't have all of its branches, is how he described it. It was kind of an interesting thing. He felt unrooted, in a sense. And suddenly, in the mid-40s, things came together for him. He published this novel. He had his analysis.
Mm-hmm.
He met his wife, which he was married then in May of 1945, which was really, for him, you know, a godsend. He just, that allowed him to continue in a happy way, I think. So meeting Reich, meeting Louise Bogen to help him and support him as he wrote The Folded Leaf, and meeting his wife were the three things that happened in 1944, 1945 that really turned things around for him. And yes, Reich believed that a writer writes his or her second self, what he called the second self, or the life unlived, in the fiction, so that he wanted Maxwell to write what could happen in a positive way, which would reflect what he would hope for his patient. And so, therapeutically, it may have worked very well. Artistically, it didn't work as well. But anyway, it's a very interesting study for me to see how Reich influenced him so much. And Maxwell continued to see him periodically. I even found bills in the 60s, in the 1960s, and he said even just a touch on his part could turn him completely yeah. around if something was going a little wrong. So he was a very important figure, very interesting and a prolific writer, Reich. So he was a very interesting man.
Well, let's talk with someone else here. We have a caller in Springfield.
Oh, great.
On our toll-free line 4. Hello.
I have a question about what were the influences that those who Maxwell edited had on his writing through his life, because I know he edited John Updike and a number of other people like that. What were the principal impacts there? And then also, are any of his writings subject to being turned into movies?
Oh, good question. First of all, that's an interesting question. The influence of the writers Maxwell worked with on his own work. Max, I think the main thing is with working with other people's writing for years and years, he tried to get them to be their own self. He was a light editor. He didn't do a lot with their work, and he was working, of course, with wonderful writers. But I think it helped him to streamline his own prose. As he got older, his prose became sparser and more barren. I think that is a result directly, and he said so actually, of him honing the prose of other people and just streamlining it and making it smoother in some senses, but primarily more bare and simple prose. And he came back to writing about writing the way, as he said, people spoke in Illinois. That was his sort of standard for how his language and his book should sound, how people in Illinois speak. Let's see. And what was the second question?
Are any of his short stories or novels being turned into movies, or are they perhaps subject to being turned into them?
Well, that was unfortunately, or fortunately, depending on your view, that was one thing that he did not want. He didn't want, and I know he turned down offers to write screenplays for The Folded Leaf and So Long, See You Tomorrow in particular, but it's one thing he didn't want at all, so I really don't think it will happen, at least for a good number of years. Thank you.
Thank you.
All right, thank you. And again, other questions are welcome. 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. One of his first jobs, I don't think he did this very long, but he was working for a film studio, and they hired him to do synopses of
right.
of scripts, and apparently he hated it. That might have influenced somewhat his idea about what the whole business of Hollywood is about and what it might do to his work.
It did.
If it got turned into a movie.
Right. And he wanted to be a serious writer, what he considered to be a serious novelist and short story writer. And he did not have any interest at all. He did, however, help Sally Benson, who you may know of, who did a lot of writing. She had a play that he helped her with, but he had no interest in going out there. I'm sure it could have been very lucrative for him. I'm sure he could have done very well, but he wanted to write his own fiction, and between editing the work of others at The New Yorker and writing his own work, and I think he did the right thing. He wouldn't have had this body of work if he hadn't. He was a slow writer as it was, so I think he made the right choice.
He was at The New Yorker for 40
yes.
years,
uh-huh.
right? When
yes.
he started, I think we had mentioned in the beginning, when he started, the magazine was only 10 years old. And this would have been, I suppose a lot of people would have thought, it was the golden era of The New Yorker.
Yes.
I mean, depending on how you feel,
right.
I still think it's a pretty good magazine. But a lot of people would think that was the golden age. Were there some ways, do you think, that he was directly responsible for what The New Yorker became?
In some ways, absolutely. He worked with tried to attract some specific writers to The New Yorker. Well, Eudora Welty is one example. She had not written for The New Yorker at all, and he wrote to her. He met her, I think, 1940, and she came to New York, and he wrote her right after to say, "Would you please submit some work for us?" And ultimately, she did, and they became very close, and he worked with her. So I would say, absolutely, he was very serious about fiction. At that time, during his years there, fiction was a much larger part of the magazine than it is now. And so I think that his love for the fiction, his love for the writers, he was very close. Roger Angel, the current and still editor at The New Yorker, told me that he was closer to the writers than any editor at the magazine. And I think he created sort of a family atmosphere among his writers, even if they were across the ocean in London or wherever they were, but they felt a real kinship with him and a real love for him, mm-hmm. really, and him for them. So I think that relationship with them, the care he took with their fiction, he was always sort of the writer's advocate to the general editor. He tried not to touch their writing as much as possible. And I definitely think that affected. People wanted to write for them. Because of the way Maxwell dealt with their work and with them.
Well, and that's such a delicate relationship. It does not matter how good a writer you are. All writers benefit now and again from some editing. And I'm sure that for any writer, you got to feel pretty good about what you've done. Maybe you'd say, well, okay, there are some things here and there that maybe I could have done better. But you'd have to believe that what you did was good when you got to the point where you said, all right, I'm finished. This is it. And then for somebody else to look at it and say, well, I think maybe you might do this a little bit differently or do this a little bit differently, or I feel sort of unsatisfied by this. That can be, I'm sure, a very difficult conversation. And depending upon how you do it, how you approach that person, either that writer's going to be receptive or they're going to want to throw you out the door. And it sounds like however it was he did it. And we're talking about some people that he dealt with that are very significant writers.
Sure.
However it was he did it, he managed to have the right touch.
He did. He edited very lightly. He said he wanted them to be the best they could be. And really, but one thing I would also say is that, as particularly John Updike told me this, he had patience to work as long as a writer wanted to work on something. And Updike in particular had conferences, he said, in the evening on the phone going over manuscripts that even typically you wouldn't want to change anything after a certain point getting towards the publication. They were already typeset. And Maxwell was very patient with making any changes the writers wanted to make. And Updike particularly appreciated that, I think.
Mm-hmm. Well, we're just about at the point where we're going to have to finish.
Sure.
And I guess I would suggest for people who aren't familiar at all with Maxwell, if you'd like to learn about him, you can look at the book that Barbara Burkhardt has written, William Maxwell, A Literary Life, and then his work, all still in print, the novels still in print.
The exception of his first novel, yes.
And she particularly perhaps would recommend the short novel that we've talked about just a little bit, or at least we mentioned the title, So Long, See You Tomorrow. Was this actually his last?
It was, published novel? In 1980 originally. It also appeared in two installments in The New Yorker before that.
So that would be a distillation of his experiences, his life, everything he'd learned about writing to that point.
Yes, I think
it's
so.
Really,
absolutely.
It's really there.
Yes.
Well, and you want to mention one more time the event?
Sure. It's today at 4 p.m. at the Rare Book and Special Collections Library on the campus of the University of Illinois in the main library building. So.
And our guest, Barbara Burkhardt, she is Associate Assistant Professor of English at U of I Springfield. And the book is William Maxwell, A Literary Life. It's published by the U of I Press. Thanks very much.
Thank you so much.
Programming here on AM 580 is made possible in part by a grant from the Thrifty Nichols American Classifieds, distributed each Thursday in over 100 towns in East Central Illinois, on the web at AmericanClassifieds.com. Programs also made possible by grant from Christopher's Fine Jewelry Design, a gallery of imaginative jewelry and gifts in downtown Champaign, offering one-of-a-kind custom-design gemstone roundtables and conflict-free diamonds direct from Canada. And, of course, a very important source of the money that it takes to run the station, people who listen. If you are not a supporter of the station, now would be a good time for you to give us a call and make a pledge. 244-9455 is the number. We have volunteers, as we like to say, volunteers are standing by to take the call. And here with me in the studio is Jack Brighton, Focus 580, producer emeritus, and webmaster of AM 580.
Right. I was listening to this past hour, really enjoying the show. I mean, you know, literature on the radio. Next hour, we're going to be talking about nanotechnology, science. Science and literature on the radio, I mean, you can't pay to get that. Well, but actually, you can. And that's what we're asking you to do right now, because your support helps us keep this going. Helps. Heck, it makes it possible in the first place. Half of our budget comes from listeners like you. So please pick up the telephone to support this right now, 244-9455. That's the number to our pledge center, where volunteers are standing by, as David says, and also Maeve Riley, the editor of our Patterns magazine, our program guide, which for a pledge of $40 at our basic membership level, or $25 if you're a student or senior citizen, you will get a subscription to Patterns magazine. And Maeve, it's been a little bit of a slow hour, I believe. We
yes.
did hear from at least one student.
That's right. Annie Pepraki of Champaign called and got the special student membership. She paid half, $12.50, and then Bill and Nancy McDonald of longtime friends at WILL, picked up the other half. So thank you to Annie for giving us a call, and thanks also to Bill and Nancy for contributing to the student membership. And Annie will be receiving patterns in the mail every month, and she can feel good about supporting public radio.
Absolutely. You know, I'd like to think that the reason we don't get a lot of pledge calls on some of these, you know, fairly highbrow kind of Focus 580 programs, I say that with a smile, I'd like to think it's because everybody who listens to Focus 580 has already pledged. And, you know, that'd be a nice delusion, but we also know that really only 1 out of 10 of our listeners pledges to the station. So we really got to work on raising that number, because that's what it's going to take for us to survive in the coming economic climate. We have declines in the federal funding, state funding, university funding. The only thing that is going up is our listenership. We know that we have more people listening, and we need to do a better job of convincing you, if you are one of our listeners and haven't contributed, to make that call, 244-9455, to support the service.
Yeah. You know, the other day I was listening to This American Life, and Ira Glass and the program was talking to somebody who was an expert in public radio fundraising about the whole business.
Is there such a thing?
Well, yeah, believe it or not, there is such a thing. And the man said that they had done research and that they had found that, on average, people listen to public radio something between 5 and 7 years before they pledged.
Yeah.
And I was just sort of amazed by that. And it also made me think that there must be people listening to this radio program that have been listening for more than 7 years. And if you're not a contributor, it's time. The time has come. 7 years, it's too long to go without making a contribution. It can be at the basic level, $40, that'd be great. You want to do 75, that'd be great. It's completely up to you. But as Jack mentioned, it is so important, because we know that the ground, it's a shifting ground on which we built here. It is really, really changing. We are never going to go back to the level of government support that we have had in the past. Never. That's just the fact of life. And I think that we expect in the future that the government support is going to be even less. Now, the good news is we know what we can do about that. And you know what we can do about that. We can turn to listeners and say, look, folks, if the programs are important, if the station is important to you, then we need to hear from you right now. You are standing in between us and further cuts in the service. I mean, if it's important the way we do things, the only place we can go to get the additional support as the other sources shrink, you.
That's
you who
right.
are listening right now.
244-9455. That's our pledge line. Also, our website, WILL.UIUC.edu. That's a place you can go to make a pledge online with a credit card or other means. Very simple and quick. We hope you will do it right now.
All right. As Jack mentioned, in the next part of Focus 580, we will be talking about nanotechnology. We'll have three guests, Irfan Ahmad, Brian Cunningham, John Rogers. They're all here at the University of Illinois, researchers who work in different sorts of areas. We'll talk a little bit about what nanotechnology is and the fact that some people think that it might indeed spark a new kind of industrial revolution. So that's in the next part of the show. Also, I want to mention that coming up a little bit later on the Afternoon Magazine, they will be taking your gardening questions. Diane Nolan and Chuck Voigt will be the guests. So even though it has been just a little cool lately, the forecast does call for some warmer weather, and it won't be long before we'll be out there putting in those things that love the heat, vegetables, herbs, and ornamentals. If you had questions, you can call in during the 1 o'clock hour of the Afternoon Magazine today. The show begins at noon. The host, Celeste Quinn. Right now, we're going to take a break with news and update on the markets, so stay tuned.
The Carl Center for Rural Health and Farm Safety is proud to underwrite agricultural programming on WILL. The center helps residents of rural communities with education and training in farm safety. For more information, call 217-383-4606.
On the Chicago Board of Trade, May wheat at 314.5 unchanged right now. July at 3.